Welcome to another episode of the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. I'm Yvonne Booz. This podcast goes beyond the poems by giving you a look into the artists' lives. This month's guest is former Rockford Poet Laureate Jenna Goldsmith. In this episode, she talks about her upcoming book, The Worst for Wear, and she also shares other writing aspirations.
I sometimes think I should write a whole book of poems about being dizzy.
Find out what's keeping her off balanced. Listen now. All right, Jenna, thank you so much for joining the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast for the second time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be back.
You have been doing a lot. You were the Poet Laureate, and then that changed. And then you started doing some other things. And I am happy to always get the most updated news about you. But I wanted to bring you back on because you have a book coming out. So can you tell me about the process for writing the book? And I know you have, what, is it four chat books out?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. So tell me about this process and why you wanted to write a full book.
Yeah. So this is my first full length collection of poetry, and it's a very different kind of process. You know, one of the things that I've noticed when I tell people how excited I am that I have this full length project coming out, being published, they're like, oh, I thought you already had some books. And that is true. Chapbooks are definitely publications, and they are, you know, it's exciting to release shorter groupings of poems. But there's something that's like really special about the first time that you publish a longer project, because typically that work is maybe older, and you've had a chance to revise it for a while. You're also thinking about kind of the arc of your work in a different way. Chapbooks are more about maybe a specific topic, whereas a book, you have the opportunity to provide, you know, audiences with a more of a variety of the kind of poetry that you are able to write. So it's just a different batch of poems. In this particular collection, I include a lot of really experimental work that I haven't been able to publish elsewhere. So it also kind of gives you the opportunity to throw in some stuff that's really weird and off the wall that, you know, maybe journals wouldn't be interested in. So it's very exciting to me.
Now, can you tell me for this particular book that's coming out, once you decided, hey, I am going to put out a full-length book, what did you do as far as figuring out the poems to put in there and then how to make things cohesive? I remember when I first wrote my book and I self-published, I remember a friend saying, you know, you are all over the place. You know, next time put the love poems together and put this together. And so I was like, oh, that's a good point. You know, I didn't think about that. But tell me about your process when pulling all these poems, as you mentioned, having some that were probably older that you wanted to pull in.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds a lot like my own experience, honestly. You know, when I first had enough, when I had like a critical mass of poems that I felt good about, that I, you know, wanted to include in the collection, I printed them all out, and I went down to my friend Neil's studio, which had a big open floor, like it was a giant floor, and I laid out each of the poems on the floor and kind of looked at them and said to myself, like, does this layout make sense? And then I would move them around and kind of see how the story I was trying to tell changed when I, you know, moved this poem to this area. And that was really the first time that I saw the mass of poems that I wanted to include. You know, since that time, when I sent that off to the press that I wanted to work with and that was going to be publishing the book, that order has changed significantly because of the editorial process. And I would have never been able to see the benefits of of changing some of those orderings without the help of the editors that I worked with. And so, you know, in a early iteration of the book, I had like these two sections, and the first section was supposed to tell a particular story, and then the second section was telling a particular story. And then, and now, of course, I look back at that and I'm like, ugh, cringy. Like, I would never do that now. But at the time, I needed to kind of, I needed to go through a process of seeing how things worked. So we settled on a different order and interspersed some of the poetry that I had kind of pushed together because of topic. Now it's kind of interspersed throughout the collection, which at first, the notion of doing that was very uncomfortable. Like, you get set in a certain way of thinking about the poems and the order of them. But, you know, when I played around with them and did what my editors were kind of gently suggesting that I do, it really improved. It really did. So, you know, you have to be open to, you know, what your friend was telling you. Like, you have to be open to that and at least see how it works if you're going to expect, you know, audiences to kind of go along with you on that journey.
What was their reasoning for taking them apart? Like, what did they have to tell you to kind of sell you on that to say, okay, it makes sense, I get it?
Yeah, it for me, so this portion of poems, I had like three or four, what I call in my head, like my high school poems. They're not written from, they weren't written in high school, but they're about high school, kind of reflections on some stuff from that time period. And I had them at the end, like I said, in sort of this like block. And the editors were like, what if you interspersed these high school poems so that you were kind of going back and forth in a chronology? So you would have like a very contemporary poem and then almost like a remembrance back to this high school time period. And then you would jump ahead to something again, more contemporary. And then a few poems later, kind of jump back to this remembrance. And it sounds very chaotic, but it actually works. It's, the book is not very long. And so, you know, it does work. It has this quality about it that feels kind of reflective. And then we're back in the present moment and then we're reflecting again. And it, and the editors were kind of able to see that, whereas I couldn't see that.
What are you planning to do once this book comes out?
So the book is coming out on the 27th of January. That's when its official publication date is. And after that, so I'll have an event at our hometown indie bookstore, Maze Books, downtown Rockford, that evening. And I'll be releasing information about that soon. Once the book is out, I will have a few more events where I'll be reading from the book and selling copies of it. And I'm actually taking a short course in publishing right around that time period. It just happens to be around that time period because the process of publishing a book is kind of complicated. If you feel like you want to kind of do it right and make sure that audiences are aware, and it doesn't just stop at the publication day. You know, the publication process continues on after that book drop because you want audiences to find your work. And you want to make sure that you keep the momentum going at least for a period of time after the publication so that, again, audiences are able to find the work. And so I'll be doing a few things around town, and I incentivized, because pre-ordering is really important in the publishing world now, I'm incentivizing pre-ordering by doing something a little bit off the wall. I don't know, we'll see what people think of this, but I created a soundtrack for the book of songs that I was listening to while I was writing a lot of these poems. And I wanted to have something kind of physical that people could take away with their purchase. And so I made CDs. Now, many people don't have CD players, I'm finding out through this process, which makes me both sad.
Maybe in their car.
In a car. That's like the last, yeah. It's like
their DVD player.
Right. Or like Xbox or, you know,
yeah.
Something like that.
Still plays for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. So, you know, it's still relevant. So I have these. They come with a pre-order. So somebody pre-orders the book and they send me a receipt or, you know, a screenshot or something. They'll get one of these. And they're all different. They're designed. They're hand-drawn, designed by my friend Linda DeYoung in this kind of like early 2000s nostalgia design. And they're cool. They're like, it's a cool thing to have. So I'm trying to keep that momentum going and figuring out cool ways for my audience to reach this book.
And when you talk about listening to songs, I can say that there are times I sit back and listen to a song and then felt like, oh, I need to write. Even if it was like one word or one line. I remember listening to a Tupac song and he said something about relocating. And I was like, I like that concept. And I was able to write this whole poem. Had nothing to do with his song or what he was talking about, but just that word and using it in such a way that people don't use it anymore.
Yeah.
Have you been doing that most of your writing experience, like listening to other mediums and incorporating that or just using it for inspiration for what you write?
I have found that, you know, for me, listening to music, reflecting back on how particular songs made me feel does kind of feed into the writing process. And some people will say, oh, you know, I can only write in silence or, oh, I don't have those kinds of associations with music and writing. But, you know, for me, I am a very nostalgic person. I think that right now, especially, there is this nostalgia for sort of early 2000s. Like that's the moment that we're in. And as a millennial myself, I'm deep in that. And so I've been listening to a lot of music from that time period. And it has sparked, you know, particular feelings for me. And I'll listen to the same song over and over and over again. And that will kind of spark a creative output. Those things go hand in hand for me. I think, you know, anybody who listens to the CD that comes with this are probably maybe going to be a little bit surprised. I didn't include any like Nickelback or anything like that, which some folks will remember like that I do like Nickelback, and that is embarrassing for people. It's not embarrassing for me, but you won't find any of that on here. It's like much cooler music. But there are some surprises on there, too. I listen to, you know, a wide variety of music.
Give me a couple of examples of, and it doesn't have to be songs that's on the CD, but songs that you listen to during this process.
So early on, one of the very first events that I did as Poet Laureate was really, really cool. The chamber orchestra for the Rockford Symphony Orchestra was having a chamber concert at the Rockford Art Museum, and the quartet was playing The Lark Ascending, which is a classical piece. And they asked me, and again, this was like very early on, you know, maybe the second month of it would have been around February. So the second month of being Poet Laureate, they asked me to come and read the poem that is kind of based on that song. And I was very nervous about this. I had never read at like a, you know, orchestral event. It was very fancy. And I had never heard the song before. I mean, I'll admit it, like when they said, you know, you're going to be reading this poem, which is a classic poem. I had never heard the piece. I immediately, of course, found it on YouTube and I could not get enough of it. I mean, I was so spellbound by this piece of music. I just listened to it on repeat, and it's long. I mean, it's like a 15-minute song. But I found there's a very short version of it at the very end of the CD. But I found it so inspiring and moving. I don't typically listen to classical music when I'm writing. I know a lot of folks do. But that piece was just, it just blew my mind. So, you know, that's an example of something very unexpected that because of my role at the time, I was exposed to that. I wouldn't have been otherwise.
Now, I want to take a moment to talk about the title of the book. Can you tell me what inspired this title?
The book was originally called something different, and it was not very concrete. Like it felt kind of like an inside joke with myself. Like I didn't know if it was something that would really resonate. Although I was very attached to it in the beginning, I at some point decided to scrap it. And the title is actually, it's an old-fashioned saying. It's not something that people are even familiar. It's sort of idiomatic. So the worse for wear, you know, it's not a common phrase that we hear in contemporary speech or discussion. And even, you know, many people have actually asked me, like, what does that even mean? Like, I'm not familiar with that phrase. But it's how I feel. I mean, the worst for wear kind of, you know, it's this feeling of like being a little bit bedraggled, being a little bit run down. But I also think of it as a phrase that denotes I'm still here. Like, this has been a tough process for me of over the last few years. I definitely feel a little beat down, you know, kind of metaphorically, my immune system is running a little low, sometimes actually. But I feel present. I feel still around. You know, I took the challenges of the last few years and spun them into gold, and you know, here I am. I'm here. I'm the worse for wear, but I'm here. So that's kind of where the title comes from. I also do love W sounds, and just I am drawn to that. So that probably is why it kind of came to mind.
Yeah, I never heard that before. Yes, we all have something we love to hear. All right, so I want to take a moment and have you read at least one poem right now, and then we'll circle back and read another one, and then we'll talk about that poem.
Okay. So I'm going to read an early poem. This is actually the second poem in the collection, and it's one of the high school poems written just a few years ago, but it's about Valentine's Day. It's called Valentine's Day. It's about something that happened to me while in high school. I had this freak accident where during gym class, I was running for a soccer ball or something, and I ran into another student, and we both busted our heads open.
No.
It's a very like typical, you know, high school drama. So this poem is about that experience and the person who kind of saved me after that went down. So, Valentine's Day, and it's for KJ. When my legs swing out from under me, I don't know your plans. You simply kneel down, knees pressed against a sandy, slick gym floor to catch my hot cheek. From some periphery, your crouch says, you're fine. And I know I am, even as blood closes over my temple, edges the hairline like the semicircle of mouths circling my pitched frame. It might be a lie, the circle of mouths. Never peeked to look, knew better than that. I do know my own lips parted, not in a circle, but in a straight line for some sound. Were you there? Don't answer that. Nobody knows anything in high school or anyone. Now tell me everything.
You can start by explaining the white shorts, your free throws, where you sat in Spanish, the white ribbon in your hair. I thought I knew your destiny certainly better than I knew my own. What I thought was new was me. I didn't have to worry about you the way I did others and myself. When my face heals, a little voice imagines thanking you. I give you a chocolate from Valentine's Day, an excuse to gift a memory, something sweet and impermanent to disappear inside you, to forget if you, to my relief, choose to remember, if you, to my relief, choose.
Oh, that was lovely. And then the circle of mouths, you know, I would have never thought about that. You know, people looking like,
yeah,
asking. That was a wonderful way to say that. How long did it take to write that poem?
Oh, my gosh. I wrote this. So this is a little bit embarrassing, but there are so many ways to write poetry. Like we don't all write the same and we don't all write the same all the time. This was composed originally very quickly. It was something that I wrote very fast, just in an afternoon, because I was doing it for kind of an exercise. Like I had kind of given myself this prompt to do it. But I've been revising it for, you know, 3 years at this point, 2 or 3 years. And it's changed a lot over time. But the experience has, you know, remained the same.
Oh, I love that. But 3 years sounds like a long time. I don't feel bad now because I have stuff, even two lines where I'm like, I gotta do something with this. Or so, okay, 3 years, that's a long time, Jenna. How do you sit with that?
I don't know. I tell people this, like the only thing that's taught me patience in life is poetry. You know, you cannot force it. You just can't. It's not going to be very good. It takes a long time for something to get good. Unless it's just kind of some like one-off, you know, brilliant thing that you're able to do, but I'm not able to do that. Like it takes me a long time and you have to wait for others to find it as well.
Now, I know that when we talked last time, when we talked about you being the poet laureate and how you had to write, you know, about certain things. But I want to know, since you haven't been the poet laureate and just being in Rockford, I know there are a lot of poets in Rockford and there are a lot of events. Can you tell me what inspires you to keep that pen moving?
Yeah, I will admit, I mean, after I was done being poet laureate, I was pretty burnt out. I didn't realize how burnt out I was until over the summer, this past summer. So it even took a couple of months after handing over the laurels to realize just how burnt out I was. And I haven't been writing a lot of poetry, not like usual. But I think that has to do more with the fact that I have embarked on a prose project. I've actually written a draft of a memoir style piece of writing about the experience of being poet laureate and what that taught me, as well as kind of a brief exploration of what I call in the book municipal poet laureates, of which there's like no writing about. So state, county, town, city poet laureates. There's really no writing about those roles that you can access. So it's a new project for me. I'm not used to writing this kind of work, but it's really exciting and it feels different, you know, than what I was doing as poet laureate. So I have a lot of energy for that right now instead.
What is the difference, if you could compare, between writing this compared to writing your poetry?
Yeah. I may admit, like, there is something that can be very quickly satisfying about writing prose. Maybe it is because of that patience piece. You don't have to have as much patience, for me, with a piece of prose than you have to write with poetry, because there's more of like an ease in writing sentences and storytelling on the page.
I'm still very attentive to sound, and I'm still attentive to diction and the kinds of things that go into writing a poem. But there's also something like deeply satisfying about just telling a story on the page and not paying attention to the same kind of like granular stuff that you're used to with the poetry. So when I work on the memoir project for a day and I'm able to, write 1,000 words, it just feels like satisfying. Like you shut the laptop and you're like, that's nice.
Now, I know some of my favorite authors, when they write, I see poetry all through their writing. Are you finding that you're doing this using the similes and metaphors and other components of poetry, even though you're writing prose? I see that all the time, and I think that's the best writing. I love to read that type of writing.
Me too. That kind of lyricism and prose writing when you're like, oh, wow, that's beautiful. That's really beautiful. I don't know. I mean, maybe the jury is still out. It feels, since it does feel a little foreign to me to be doing this, I'm self-conscious about it. Like, I'm like, am I doing this right? Like, I don't know how to do this. I didn't take any classes in this when I was in college, and therefore I feel self-conscious about it. But I also remind myself every day, every time I sit down to work on this project, like, it is what it is. It is what it's going to be. I'm not at the stage yet where I can be, submitting this to anybody. It is just doing what it's going to do, and it's going to be my story no matter what. So that does give me some relief.
Now, I know when we talked in the past, you talked about like the university that you published through, mm-hmm. and I see looking at what you sent me that it's still like a university type press.
Yeah.
Can you tell me why you want to go that way as opposed to even self-publishing? Because with the tools that we have and technology we have these days, it's so easy to just self-publish and hire an editor to take care of that part and just to send it to the printer is easy, I think, to do that with everything that we have as far as technology today. Why did you choose to continue to go through a publisher?
Yeah, I have struck, lightning has struck twice for me with this process, really, because I have been thrilled. I'm thrilled to be able to be working with this particular press. My colleague, one of my colleagues in the field and a professor at RVC, she published a book. Sarah Ettlinger published a book with this press a couple years ago. And when I got my hands on it, I thought it was so well done. It's beautiful. It's a high quality. And she reported having a really good experience with this press. And so it was sort of in my mind. It's also a press that aims to publish particularly Midwestern writers who are writing in some way, shape, or form about kind of the Midwest experience. And because it's a teaching press, you're working with students throughout the whole process who are, looking to go into the publishing world and are being trained to do that. So it's a neat experience because you're working with students at kind of the very beginning of their professional lives as people. And they might, they might not go into publishing, but many of them do, or, some area of the book world. And so it's very special to be able to do that and to work with them. I also wanted to work with more of a traditional press because there are certain elements of the publishing process that I don't necessarily want like anything to do with. Like, I am not a good marketer of my own work. I'm not great at social media. Like I said, I'm a millennial. So like Facebook, I'm good at. Like that is, I can do Facebook. But even like getting into my Instagram is not very good. Don't even ask me about videos. I don't know how to do any of that. I need to learn. But, when you work with a press, that stuff is included for the most part. There is a lot of partnership that goes on between writers and presses when it comes to marketing. And that has increased over time as presses have less and less resources to spend on stuff like that. But if you're involved with a press, you can have experts be doing some of the stuff that you don't necessarily want to do. I also just love having kind of those built-in editors, people who, you know, really know what they're talking about. I need that. I just need it for my own process. I like that. So, you know, you're kind of inviting in some expertise in areas that maybe you don't feel super confident in when you're working with a more traditional press.
Now, I know earlier in the conversation, you mentioned something about taking a class in publishing. Can you talk more about that?
Mm-hmm. I'm a Substack reader. Like, I don't know how common that is, but I follow several Substacks, so online newsletters about publishing. I try to stay up on that stuff so that I can send it to my students and also stay current myself. And one of the Substacks that I follow is called Publishing Confidential, which is like a Substack about publishing. It kind of pulls back the curtain on the publishing world and showcases, you know, this is how publishing like kind of works. And the woman who writes it announced that she was doing, you know, this kind of short course every Wednesday night for a couple of months on how to see your book through the publication process. And of particular import to me was what you brought up earlier, Yvonne, and that what happens after the book is published? Like, do you just stop talking about, like, what do you do? The excitement, you know, is kind of over in that space. You need to keep talking about it, though. You need to keep marketing it. And so one of the things that she's doing in this class is teaching you how to keep the momentum going. That's really something I want to know more about.
I know that that's good to know and to have that, because if not, you'll just have books sitting around.
Right. I don't want them in my apartment. Like, I have, you know, hit me up. I got a lot of chapbooks in my apartment. Okay. And I'd like to have less of them. So
now I want to take a moment and have you read something else from the book that you think our audience would like to hear.
One more here. This is a contemporary poem. This is one of the ones that I wrote within the last couple of years about my current situation. I just tell you a little bit so that this makes sense. I have this very unfortunate syndrome. I have a vestibular injury, which means that my equilibrium is always off. So I have a dizziness disorder. It has a lengthy name that I won't try to say, but essentially I have a dizziness disorder, and it's not always the kind of spinning vertigo that we associate with dizziness, but it's always with me. And I've had lots of good physical therapy, and I, you know, take care of myself in certain ways, but it's hard. It's like a hard thing to deal with in my everyday life. And so I've written some poetry to kind of process that. And so this poem is about my latest round of physical therapy with a wonderful physical therapist in Belvedere. Actually, we have a very specialized physical therapist in Belvedere for this, which is incredible. So the poem is called Vestibular Weakness. It always starts this way. Pull left shoulder away from left ear. Depress cranium, cradle neck, spine, skull, and neck again. Myofascials, a new word to me. Muscles in the scalp. I've arrived. On this woman's floor, can't walk a straight line. She doesn't know I'm a poet, only that I write poems. I spin a wheel with my feet. We watch videos of her golf prodigy middle schooler on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. Never respected golf until today. He's a smart boy, she says. I say, don't send him to any university in our town, and she nods solemnly. I regret that. I'm just mad at my shoulders. slouched so long I've shortened those muscles and compressed my right rib so it sits inside its neighbor like two crammed siblings in a van's back seat on a family vacation. I've feared becoming my humpbacked great Aunt Peg, and well, here I am. Things shift within me. The space between my shoulder and elbow isn't as it once was. Please allow this upsetness worthy of my age.
I love the way you put that. And to think about being mad at your body part, that's insane. But I love that you're able to describe it that way and say, this is what I'm going through. And so now the title makes a lot of sense. Now that you told me about that, now I understand a little more of what that title means. And I'm sorry that you have to go through that, but you can never tell. Like you seem like you were fine. You're upbeat when I see you in person. Yeah. But I think it's important to talk about things like that because there are other people
who may not know.
They're like, oh, wow, she was the poet laureate.
Right. Or they're going through it themselves, you know, and they're like, oh, I have dizziness too. Like, is that a thing? Because I didn't know anything about that until it happened. And now I'm in, you know, these Facebook support groups for it. And there's just thousands of people who are dealing with this every day. So, you know, it's one of those things that I've wondered, you know, how am I going to deal with this? I read a book last year. It was one of my the favorite books that I read last year. And it was a poetry book, but it was a guy writing about his early onset kind of blindness. And that really intrigued me because, you know, I sometimes think I should write a whole book of poems about being dizzy. And I know that the content is there. I just need to sit down and do it. And I haven't been able to do it yet, but that's something that I maybe down the road I could do.
You know, the poems can be totally different. Happy, sad, yeah. Mysterious.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you for reading that poem for me. Now, I want to talk about some of the poetic forms you're using throughout the book. I'm not well versed in all of the forms, but I see there's like a concrete poem where mm-hmm. it's like, you know, the words type kind of turns into a picture, if I'm describing this correctly.
Yep.
Tell me about some of that and how intentional it was to have different forms in your book. Because for me, I think using poetic forms, it forces me to really write more intensely. Yeah. It's not as easy because it's like I have to fit in this particular, I have to put this key into this lock and it has to be this way. Whereas free verses, whatever comes out.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It is a way to shake process up a little bit. I have found that if I'm feeling kind of at a loss, like if I'm just feeling a little bit stagnant, like I don't have almost the energy to write a free verse poem. Like if I'm like, oh, I just don't want to pay attention to it that much today. Like that's almost like the thing that occurs to me right now. I will go towards a form just to generate something. So for instance, there's the light bulb poem in there with the actual like shape of a light bulb. There's poetry that's sort of meant to invoke certain visualizations because of the way that it's shaped. There's some erasure poetry in there based on some old emails. I'll let listeners onto a little like secret. Sometimes poets really want to just spill the tea on certain things, but they can't because that's not nice. And you won't win any friends that way. So you have to think about, you know, creative ways, make it into art. So there's some emails in here that are like, they say even, let me see if I can find the inscription for one of them. Sorry.
Well, take your time. And while you're looking, I just wanted to make a comment about spilling the tea as a poet. And that's what empathy is for. Like, you write it and you don't name names, and you put yourself in that person's shoes, and nobody knows who you're talking about, but you know.
That's right. And that's where patience comes in too. You put that away, because in a week you're gonna be embarrassed. Like, you might not be embarrassed, but you'll be glad that you saved that one for something else, right? You put it in the drawer, because you can always come back to stuff like that. Like, you don't have to just shuttle it off. The little inscription that I have with some of these poems, which are called the relief poems, you know, for instance, it says relief version 2, an erasure and pronouns from a period of email starting April 4th, 2023 and ending April 5th, 2023. And it's just the pronouns from the email. So it's interesting kind of on its surface. There's no inside joke. There's nothing really to analyze. It's just kind of artistic there on the page. But in my mind, it like scratches an itch. And I think that we're only human. We're only human. I think that, you know, artists and poets would maybe be not honest with themselves or others if they said that all of their poetry was, you know, completely innocent in that way, right? Like, we make artistic choices for certain reasons. And so I have no idea how we got on this topic, but I really feel like I've just told you a lot, Yvonne. Oops.
I'm sorry. I have that effect on people, Jenna. But I was reading the poem, looking at it as you were talking, and no one's going to know what email that was from, but you know, and that's the satisfying part. Because I'm looking at it and I'm like, me, you, her, all, I, you, my, someone, our. That tells me nothing.
No, people like, well, it's very experimental, you know, it's innovative. And people will say, you know, I don't really get this. And I'm like, there's really nothing to get. Promise. Like, just let it wash over you. Come up with some stories in your head, you know, about what this could be about. That's fun. I invite people to do that. But, you know, it's not, you're not going to crack a code of any kind.
All right. Just a couple of more questions before I wrap up. I would like to know, how is your interaction with other poets? Like, do you go to workshops? Do you have like a poetry group that you're a part of? And if so, how does that impact your writing?
Yeah, my interaction with other poets has changed, you know, over the years. Like, there have been times in my life when I've had a really solid kind of writing group that we meet really regularly, and we're sharing poetry, and it's a very intentional, it's hard to be consistent with that. It's hard to get, nowadays, it's hard to get, you know, even three or four people in the same room consistently because we're all so busy. But I've had times where that's been the case, and it's been wonderful. Other times during COVID, for instance, a lot of stuff became much more accessible weirdly because people were on Zoom and you could dip into a writing group, or you could, you know, talk to people across the country really easily, or you could watch a reading really, really easily. The barrier of entry was very low during COVID. And I, in some ways, I miss that. I really do. There's not as many events that are online anymore or accessible in that way. But at this period of my life, you know, my interaction with other poets is first and foremost on the page. I'm a voracious consumer of poetry. I read as much, you know, poetry as I can get my hands on. I'm also somebody who is like that rare reader who is kind of obsessed with reading about publishing. Like, I'm interested in, you know, how people are doing the work that they're doing as well, not just the primary source that they're putting out, but also people talking about writing and talking about publishing. So I interact with ideas that way. Since I've moved to Rockford, I have the benefit of interacting with, you know, poets who are just sort of doing their thing. I work remotely, but I work with a lot of writers still. And so I'm interacting with writers that way. So, you know, it's evolved over time and it will continue to in different ways. I think that it's a challenge nowadays to have stable writing groups. I fantasize about it. I don't currently have one. But it's something that I'm always thinking about. Like, how can I bring people together, even if we just write and don't talk? We just have an accountability group. It's something that I think about a lot, but I haven't, you know, been able to make happen.
Maybe you can start a poetry group.
I know
when I was a part of one,
which it lasted for over a decade. In Aurora, it was myself and another woman started it, and that would make me write because every month I had to write something. But there were times when we would do a outing, and we would go to like a park or somewhere, and we would disperse and write and then come back and go over mm-hmm. what we wrote. So like little field trips. I know in Rockford, there's so many things and places you guys can go to the museum and write a poem, you know.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's an idea if you wanted to explore that more.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that sounds lovely. That's like the ideal. That's like the ideal situation right there.
If there are people who could do it. So I'm full of ideas. Now, how about I just implement those for myself? That's always the problem.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Now, is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners? Maybe something that I did not even ask you.
I'm just so excited and thrilled, like I said earlier, about the opportunity to work with this press. It was a truly wonderful experience working with the students. It's really important, and I will, you know, bang the gong on this any chance I get. It's so important to support small presses. I read a statistic recently about kind of updating the public on how many small presses there still are that are active, and compared to how many of the big four publishes. There's really like four big conglomerate publishers. There's a lot of amazing writing that's coming out of the big publishing houses, but for every amazing book that you see right when you walk into Barnes and Noble, on that, you know, first table right there, there's 10 incredible books that are published by small presses that, you know, maybe will sell 100 copies in their lifespan. And so I encourage everybody to look into university presses if they're interested in regional writing or writing that's really on specific topics. Small presses that are working on a shoestring budget and are just doing like amazing publishing work. And thinking about those too when you're buying books. Looking at the spine of a book to see like who's publishing this? Do I want to support them? And just being a more informed reader, I guess. But I'm ecstatic to be working with this press and really excited. You know, January is kind of a dark and cold time. And so this will be a little like burst of fun and lightness at the end for me, at least.
Jenna, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Wonderful. Always wonderful speaking with you.
Thank you for listening to the Poetically Yours Extended Podcast. Listen to Poetically Yours every Friday on 89.5 FM WNIJ or our classical station 90.5 WNIU. Music provided by the Nick Monte Trio Band. For Poetically Yours, I'm Yvonne Booz.